Hello, I'm Claire Wright, Professor of Public Engagement at La Trobe University. Welcome to Literary La Trobe, a podcast showcasing the writing and research of La Trobe University's staff, students, alumni, and adjuncts. The recording you're about to hear is from the 2024 Bendigo Writers' Festival. I was fortunate to be the co-curator of the Bendigo Writers' Festival in 2024, programming a suite of sessions under the La Trobe Presents banner. The festival took place on the second weekend of August on the unceded country of the Dja-Dja-Wurrung and Tungurung peoples of the Kulin Nation. When do neighbours become good friends or enemies? In this event, three security analysts, La Trobe Asia's Professor Beck Strating, Alan Bem, and Dr. Carly Moore-Gilbert discuss the finer points and the security challenges facing Australia today, with host, La Trobe Senior Adjunct Research Fellow, Dr. Sally Warhoft. Please note, some of these live events may contain strong language. I hope you enjoy.
Good morning, everyone, and a very warm welcome to the Bendigo Writers' Festival. It's so fabulous to see you all and to be back. My name is Sally Warhoft, and I'm a freelance troublemaker from Melbourne. I'm also an adjunct senior research fellow at La Trobe, and given that this session is very, very proudly brought to the festival today by La Trobe University, I thought that I would add that on, and also to let you know it's being recorded for La Trobe University for the Literary La Trobe podcast, and all 17 of the podcasts that La Trobe sponsored last year, including Helen Garner, Dom Watson, Christos Cholkas, they're all up there and you can find them on your favourite podcast provider. We're very proudly here in Bendigo on Dja-Dja-Wurrung land, and I acknowledge all the elders, either here with us or not. So welcome. Security starts at home. When do neighbours become good friends or enemies? It's an absolute pleasure to introduce our three guests this morning. Professor Beck Strating is Director of La Trobe Asia and a Professor of International Relations at La Trobe University. Her focus is on Asian regional security, maritime disputes, and Australian foreign and defence policy. She's the author of three books, including Defending the Maritime Rules-Based Order, and is co-author of Girt by Sea with Professor Joanne Wallace, which is very freshly out. Alan Bem specialises in international security policy, risk evaluation, and negotiating the interface of policy and politics. And if we have time, I'm going to ask him exactly what that means. He is formerly Chief of Staff to Greg Combe in the climate change and industry portfolios, and he was a senior advisor to Penny Wong, I think during the Trump years, is that right? Trump won? Yes, so when she was in opposition.
Much more fun.
His books include No Minister, No Enemies, No Friends, and The Odd Couple, The Australian-America Relationship. And Dr. Carly Moore-Gilbert, scholar of Middle Eastern and Islamic Studies and the author of the superb memoir, The Uncaged Sky, My 804 Days in an Iranian Prison, which of course detailed her detainment on false espionage charges from September 2018 to November 2020. Please give our fabulous panel a warm welcome. I want to begin with just a broad question about security, which is to ask each of you your sense of how secure we are in Australia. And Beck, you're going to go first.
What a great question. I have to say it's a real delight to be back at the Bendigo Writers' Festival and to have Sally hosting us for this conversation. I guess one of the questions that Joanne and I try to interrogate in our book is this question of what security is. And so getting to your question of how secure are we? I think we first really need to understand, how do we understand security as a concept? And I think one of the things that we tend to do in Australia is really think about security from the lens of, you know, the white settler colonial state. What the government tells us is security is really about defending population. It's about defending territory. It's about defending infrastructure. But what we talk about is broadening out our concept of security. So we want to talk about things like environmental security. We want to talk about things like securing society, securing the ways that people live, our freedoms, our civil liberties as well. We want to talk about how we keep our institutions safe and resilient as well. These are all important facets of security. And what I think we're seeing, certainly over the last 5 years, but even perhaps longer than that, is this tendency in the national security community, of which I am a part and Joanne is a part, but a tendency to really just focus on one big thing in security, and that one big thing is China and what the rise of China means for Australia's security. But there's a lot of oversimplified narratives. It's not as if we're arguing that the rise of China doesn't have security implications for Australia in a traditional sense. It does. It's important to understand those. However, it's not the only thing that Australia should be focused on. And so we are probably less secure than what we were 10 years ago, but we're also not really in the zone of facing an imminent invasion. But you wouldn't necessarily know that from some of the commentary that can go on in the media.
Mm. Kylie, how do you come at that question? How secure are we in Australia?
Just listening to what Beck was just saying then, I'd completely agree, and I'd say that rather than looking at defence of the borders necessarily, our internal security inside our own country is what troubles me more. And certainly on a completely different, from a completely different angle, I guess the threat of transnational repression is something that I've really had personal, unfortunately personal, contact with myself, and know many others who have. And I can definitely say that, yes, China has really been the sole focus there too. You know, Chinese influence infiltrating our societies and our migrant communities or whatever. But there are a whole lot of other countries and other targeted migrant communities out there that don't have that big, you know, focus on them and don't have resource allocation or recourse to government assistance there. And that really became apparent in the past couple of years. And, you know, I'm not just thinking about Iran, but even India. We've seen India, so, you know, friendly countries to Australia, not just our adversaries, seeking to influence us internally. And that's something that I think the government in the past has not taken seriously enough, and we're kind of playing catch up to right now.
We will get into that soon, actually, what makes a friend. Alan, how do you come at the question? And also, I suppose, to also answer how coherent our strategy is for our security.
The second part of the question is the by far the most interesting bit, and we might all come back to that because it lacks coherence almost entirely. But to start at the beginning of your question, it's important for us, I think, to look at Australia from the point of view of where it's been for at least 65,000 years. We're an immensely secure country. And for 65,000 years, very little of security relevance occurred here. It's only since people who look awfully like me turned up in 1788 that security has been any kind of issue. And certainly for the Djadjawurrung people, people who looked like me did a lot of damage. And people who looked like me were frightened of them. And so the first thing that after 1788 that happened was, of course, a massive assault, sometimes intentional, sometimes not, on the Indigenous people of Australia. And I think it's important to bear that in mind, because most of us in the room here look like each other. That's just how writers' festivals are. And It worries me because when we think of security, we very often think of security in terms of warfare. We don't actually think of it much in terms of peacefare. And yet, if I'm right, that we are, for all sorts of reasons, geographic not least of all, a massively secure country, then why aren't we thinking much more about how we prolong that rather than how we defend ourselves against threats? Threats. And remember that threats are the objectification of fear. So why do we work on the basis of being frightened when we have so much not to be frightened about? So I think we're massively secure and we don't even know it.
Beck and Alan, in your books, one really common thread is that you both implore, really, for a radical reimagining of our security policies and the way we, in fact, imagine ourselves as a country. Beck, can you talk a bit about that, what it means from your research?
Yeah, so Alan and I have slightly different takes on this. We use the term strategic imagination, but Alan, I think you're not so much a fan of the term strategic, which is fair enough. But Alan, you know, talks in his book about imagination, and essentially where I think we're trying to do very similar things, which is, as I said before, trying to test the biases and the assumptions that underpin how we talk about and how we think about securing security and who and what we are securing as well. And that really goes back to some of these questions about when we think about security, it is often in that idea of the white settler colonial state. We don't often go back to the history that Alan was talking about before. You know, we don't think about security in terms of, for example, you know, the people of the Torres Strait who are currently facing massive king tides and who have actually taken Australia to an international court and beaten the government on the fact that the Australian government has demonstrably been failing them in not providing security and not providing people an ability to inhabit their homes and their lands. So, you know, this is an alternative reading on security that's not just about nuclear-powered submarines. And, you know, one of the concerns that we have, and certainly since producing the book, I get more and more concerned about this, is how something like AUKUS, the agreement between Australia, the United States and the United Kingdom, has just seems to swallow up all of our discussion about security, and it becomes all about these nuclear-powered submarines. And that is a very small part of what we think of when we think about security. So the reimagining of Australia's security is around things like engaging, how do we engage with our neighbourhood? So Australia at the moment has this concept called the Indo-Pacific. That's how it talks about our region. And our book takes a bit of a sledgehammer to that concept, if I can say that, by pointing out that Australia still really thinks about the broader region in terms of the sub-regions, the South Pacific, the South China Sea, Southeast Asia, Indian Ocean. These are very different maritime regions that we are talking about. And our book explores those differences. You need to have a nuanced approach to the relationships in our region, and we can't just be always looking over into the distant horizons. You know, part of Australia's foreign policy has always been this idea that we need a security guarantor, but it's going to be a country that's very far away from us, and we have this deep anxiety about our geography being located in Asia. And so we go back, I think, to those sorts of principles of what drives Australian foreign and defence policy to come up, we hope, with at least the basis for changing the conversation about how we even talk about security in this country.
Sometimes security is about incredibly vulnerable individuals in a particular time and place. Kylie, I'm willing to bet that in 804 days and nights in prison, you didn't once think about submarines.
I'm racking my brains now. Did I ever think? I think I saw a terrible, like, B-grade film about a submarine. It was all CGI and it was out of China and they were, like, stuck on the submarine and they might have died in the end. We had all sorts of I watched a lot of world cinema in prison, all dubbed in Farsi. It's actually how I learned Farsi. Mm. So I saw some horrific movies and there might have been a submarine in one of them. So,
did you contemplate our security policies here in thinking about what might be happening for you while you were isolated?
I mean, obviously, insofar as it relates to my own situation, yes. And I think it might be a little bit of a stretch, but absolutely foreign regimes taking innocent Australian citizens hostage and demanding concessions from our government to leverage them diplomatically is, you know, a security issue too. And unfortunately, it's happening more and more often. And it's becoming, you know, as we saw in the recent Russia deal that happened a couple of weeks ago, where an unprecedented number of dissidents and foreign hostages were released in exchange for several Russian hitmen and other dodgy characters. It's happening quite a lot these days. So it is a security issue as well as a human rights one and, you know, a diplomatic one. So, I think, like many who find themselves in this situation, initially you expect your government to come and save you. You think, oh, you know, my government, they'll come to my rescue. I'm innocent. I've done nothing wrong. And it really teaches you the limitations, I guess, of our both our diplomatic influence and power as a sort of middle power country like Australia, but also, I guess, how diplomacy behind the scenes really is a very dirty business. And it's not secure. We have conventions, we have treaties and things, but in reality they don't really work. It taught me a lot in that sense.
It's entirely relationship-based, isn't it? And Alan, one of the things you write about is a sort of collapse of relationships in Australia. God forbid, you were to find yourself in an Iranian prison, what nationality would you wish to be?
Certainly not Iranian. I think I'd rather be the nationality that I've got. And it could be my stupidity that got me into an Iranian prison, or it could be malevolence from other people. The fact is that there are bad actors out there, and many people, as individual citizens who find themselves in prison — I'm a former diplomat and I actually got a young woman out of jail in Yala province in southern Thailand through a group of circumstances that allowed me to do that. It was entirely illegal what I did, but it didn't matter. She got out and went home to Perth. But I'm aware of what happens when citizens get caught up in things that they have no idea of. And suddenly the full weight of a nation's law will be applied to them and they wonder, what the hell has happened? How did I get here? That happens all the time, and it happens to Australians not as often as it happens to Americans or some other Europeans, but it happens more often than it should. And Kylie is an absolute expert on this, and I'm going to defer to you on every aspect of it. I'm not going to go any further there. But we all get ourselves caught up in it. The relationship aspect, though, is a much bigger question. It's about how you deal with that problem. And if you think about — I don't want to mention names, but I can think about half a dozen cases of Australians who've been caught in one part of the world or another, normally in countries which do not have a common law system or do not have a human rights ethos. So I'm not talking about Western Europe for the most part. But in Eastern Europe, certainly, Australians have been caught up in things. The nature of Australia's diplomacy and the way in which we run our relationships officially becomes critical, absolutely critical. And on the basis of my experience, and I'm quite happy to be held down here, but because people have got different ideas, but very quiet, persistent diplomacy is a far more powerful instrument than noisy jumping up and down diplomacy. Now, noisy jumping up and down diplomacy in Australia by the families of people caught up out there makes a lot of sense, because governments have got to be kept on the case. But that's for domestic consumption. If you try to impact on an Eastern European government, particularly under the old dispensation, you'll get nowhere with that. In fact, it's a provocation to hunker down. So very often how you manage your formal relationship diplomatically will differ quite a lot from how you will manage the personal relationships between families and between other governments. And not everybody in, I'll just pick a country, yeah, Hungary. Not everybody in Hungary is bad. Not everybody in the Hungarian government is bad. I have no Hungarian cases, by the way. But there are good people in those places who at least sometimes will be kind and won't be brutal. And families can actually interact with those, and I've seen it happen. So what we have to have is a fairly expansive view about how relationships in the plural actually work, Sally, I think, and to be very careful about the distinctions.
I mean, one of the things about our sort of security policy, would it be from the Second World War, perhaps even further back, is that it's just military focused. So much of it seems to be anyway, and we've seen closing of embassies. When I went to La Trobe as an undergraduate because they taught Hindi and I wanted to learn Hindi. I don't know that they teach it anymore, even at La Trobe.
We've still got it.
Have you?
Only two universities in Australia.
ANU and La Trobe.
Which is a real shame, I think.
I'm sorry to say this, Alan, but Bundoora trumped Canberra. we know.
I studied Sanskrit, by the way, and Pali and Prakrit. So I think Bundoora does trump Canberra now because they don't treat... teach that now,
we'll,
Sally.
The general point, though, that learning languages in a classroom with proper teachers and hopefully going to learn those languages in the countries where it's spoken is hugely important, and there's less and less of it. Kylie, can you talk a bit about that as well? Because you taught yourself Farsi in prison. How important is language to our security when we talk about diplomacy and vulnerability?
I'd probably broaden that out further. I think Australia is abysmal when it comes to languages, as you've just highlighted. I mean, I have a bachelor degree in Middle Eastern studies. I studied Arabic and Hebrew, and that was in the UK. It was a completely different system to here, and it was very rigorous and vigorous, and it was taken very seriously, and there was a value attached to language acquisition that there just isn't here. And it's stopping us from understanding our neighbourhood, our neighbours, countries further afield. We don't have that depth of understanding or expertise if we cannot understand the language that these people are communicating with each other in, and everything must be done on our terms, in our language, in English. And when, you know, as a scholar, when, you know, there's a bit of snobbery there, of course, but, you know, interacting in my old life when I used to be in the Middle East studies area, studies field, you would sometimes meet scholars of the Middle East who didn't speak any Middle Eastern languages and hadn't done field work in the Middle East. And I used to sort of scratch my head and think, well, how can you actually properly understand and speak with authority and have depth of knowledge of this region when you don't really know the region and you don't speak the language? But that's somehow acceptable in Australia. I don't know, I think it's a real shame. It's hard work learning a language, and, you know, I know full well if you don't use it, you lose it, and it gets rusty and you have to keep it up, and it's tough. But there's so much value in it. And, I mean, I just, you know, it makes me despair really when I hear about the number of language courses that universities have shut down now because of, you know, under subscription of these subjects and a lack of value attached to them.
Can I just jump in there? I think that's why thinking about security holistically is important, because education policy becomes a security issue. These are issues to do with, for example, how does this country fund universities? Does it have a national strategic language policy? Well, not really at the moment. This is why we have, I think it was 4 Bahasa Indonesian courses closing down 2021 or 2022 alone. And so this is a security, it's a diplomatic issue, but these things tend to get siloed. We don't necessarily recognise them as being such. The other one is immigration policy. Education's a great soft power resource for Australia. I don't know about Kylie and Alan, but when I go overseas, I often in Asia, I often meet officials in Asian countries who have been educated in Australia, and that like provides a basis for communicating and for engaging and for people having a positive view of Australia in the region.
I remember, Prime Minister Yudhoyono in Indonesia, who had studied here as a university student, and the strength of diplomatic intimacy that gave was hugely important.
And his kids studied in Brisbane.
You finish, Beck, sorry.
Well, yeah. But this is exactly right. There's a real soft power that comes with sharing our education to the world, if you like. And at the moment we have an immigration policy that's seeking to restrict the number of international students taking courses at our universities, which will have a demonstrably bad effect on a lot of universities in this country, not to mention academic jobs, but also this is where these sorts of cuts start to challenge languages. They're often on the front line because of low subscription and a lack of a national strategy. This then becomes a security issue. If we broaden out our lens, we can see that these things are interrelated and we need a holistic understanding of how they interact.
So where does that leave Australia, Alan, went to get back to the original point I made about the military led focus? How do we change it? Where should the emphasis be leaning? How do we get culture into it?
Well, it goes well beyond culture, doesn't it? I think Kylie's point about our monolingual defiance goes to the heart of it, because the only window that you can start with in looking at another culture is language. Yes, if you can have a curiosity about other cultures, and you know, you can get on a plane and go to Central Java and visit Borobudur and Prambanan and come away, and you probably don't recognise that one's a Hindu temple and the other's a Buddhist temple, because they're just there, aren't they? If you don't speak Bahasa, then you don't know much about what happens in Indonesia, and the same goes for the rest of Asia. And I mean, Kylie, it's absolutely on the money there. And it is a security issue, because without language you have no understanding. And if you don't understand your neighbours, how on earth do you interact with them? So that's why I wrote a book called No Enemies, No Friends. We have no enemies that I'm aware of, but we certainly have no friends. And we walk around the place, but particularly in the Pacific, being as condescending as all get out by describing the Pacific countries as our Pacific family. It's hard love in our family, kids, and they're not ours. I mean, that condescending element that comes all the time in the sort of our superiority in dealing with our neighbourhood is a security issue. And I don't think the AUKUS submarines are going to do anything much about fixing that, nor will the B-52s at Tyndall, nor will the Air Force's ambition to acquire B-1s or B-2s. And I'm not talking about the bananas in pyjamas, okay? So, though, mind you, bananas in pyjamas are a much greater contribution to our national security because they affect the imaginations of children. But we could talk about that some other time. But seriously, Sally, I think that this sort of defiant monolingualism goes to the heart of our inability to do other than think about threats.
Kylie, how much have you come to know since you've been back about the diplomacy that led to your release?
Not as much as I would like. And I'm actually going to put in an FOI to the government to try and get documents so that they'll redact most of them if give me anything, but we'll see. I had a few interesting chats with a few people, but these cards are kept very close to the chest of the various players involved. But I've been studying the phenomenon more broadly, and I'm involved in a lot of current cases, both of Australian current wrongful detainees held abroad in prisons right now and those in foreign countries, US, UK, Germany, Belgium, Sweden, other target countries. And there's a real pattern there, and there's a lot of similarities between people's experiences and also between the way that governments and diplomats try and solve these issues. And unfortunately, they're all quite siloed. Each country tries to reinvent the wheel each time, and we're not cooperating enough multilaterally on this issue, and we're not learning from each other's successes and mistakes too. So while I don't know the sort of nuts and bolts of my own case behind the scenes, what was happening very well, I kind of have a sense of it from studying the cases of others and understanding that there's a pattern of behaviour at play here.
We've gone over half an hour without talking about the, you know, great big bestie friend, the United States, which Alan's written a whole book on it, so I better bring it up. And because it's obviously vital to our well-being. Alan, is America a friend?
Sort of. The American relationship is a critical relationship for us, and not from a security point of view. I mean, you've got to start from where it actually grips Australia, and that means you start in the 13th century. You start a long way back to understand where Australia and America have come from. And so that's what I've tried to do. We are probably countries most similar of all countries in the world, Australia and America, for various reasons. Institutional and structural alignments between the two countries are very, very profound. And our cultural alignments are very, very profound indeed. So we have no option in reality but to deal with America as it has no option in reality but to deal with us. And that's the bit that we're really bad at. PJ Kay made a remark the week before last, which is ever so slightly crude, but I don't think there are very many children in the room. So I will expand a little on what Keating said, and he just described Australia as the sand shoes hanging out the arse of the United States. And that sort of captures it in a way, because we don't exercise our own agency in that relationship. Back to your earlier question, that to sort of operationalise a relationship, I put that in for Beck.
We love a weasel word, don't we?
I'll get strategic in a moment. But to get our relationship working, we have to understand that we've got massive agency, and that what drives our agency is very considerable national power. But we don't think of it. Does anybody remember where Australia came on the Olympic medals table? Yes. Don't you think that's extraordinary?
Yes.
And, I mean, it truly is extraordinary, because winning medals is not powerful, but what it represents is, because it means we are right up there as a very rich country. A really, really rich country. And yet, how do we talk? Sally, we talk about punching above our weight. And anybody who's ever gone into a ring, boxing ring, I mean, will know that the last thing you ever do is punch above your weight. And why? Because you will be flattened. So the reason I think that we don't deal with America in a grown-up way is partly because we're not grown up, and partly, and I think more importantly, we don't understand the nature of our power in that relationship, and we don't leverage it.
How do you see the America relationship, Beck?
Look, I think it's an important point to be talking about agency. I think probably where I would diverge slightly is that there are examples where Australia does and has exercised its agency in the relationship with the United States. And sometimes the problem is not that we kind of just follow the United States in whatever they're doing. The problem is really with leadership in Australia and the fact that sometimes our leaders are unable to conceptualise characterise Australia's national interest as being divorced from what the US national interest is. And so that's kind of how leaders get socialised into understanding the alliance. And that's what really, I think, one of the things that concerns me is that the deferential approach to the US means that sometimes it's difficult to separate the fact that we have our own unique national interests that we need to secure, and that that is central to being self-reliant in an alliance context, which is a phrase that you often hear from defence and strategic thinkers, if you like. So maintaining that agency, I mean, it's very difficult to just cut the tie, like with the United States. That's not a pragmatic, it's not a feasible option for Australia.
I think you actually added it up in your book, didn't you, that we'd have to increase our GDP, one of you did, by 3 or 4%.
So that's the estimations vary depending on who's doing the studies. But the enormous cost to Australia in defence procurement and in building capability would be extraordinary. But this is a path dependence issue. This is the fact that it didn't just start with AUKUS, right? AUKUS is just the last stage of this historical evolution of Australia. The defence officials call it interoperability, this idea of our militaries being able to work much more closely and in an integrated fashion means that divorcing from the United States in a defence setting is not realistic. But the question is, how do we maintain our agency so that we can make decisions confidently as a confident actor, as a mature actor? But also, how do we hedge against our dependence? What options do we have, say, in our neighbourhood that means that if, you know, on the off chance the United States potentially under the next Trump administration does decide to back away from alliances in Asia, that's you know, that's something that could potentially happen with Korea and Japan. And if that happens, that's, you know, going to entirely upend the alliance system in Asia with massive implications for Australia. So we need to be thinking about, all right, this is our plan A, but what have we got in reserve? And I don't think that we are too optimistic about the United States, I think.
You read every white paper, the Defence Strategic Review last year, and you would think the world had not changed. That's the thing that always strikes me with these reviews and what policy is built upon.
See, that's interesting because I think on the one hand, that's true in the fact that our posture doesn't really change. Like we're still, like there's this paradox of we have this fear of abandonment. And so what do? We become more dependent on the United States rather than less dependent. It's a paradoxical thinking. And it does seem true that we follow down the path. But then at the same time, those documents also tell us things like the threat is urgent. We have no warning time. The strategic environment has shifted. But it's like we don't internalise that change. Like we know it's happening, but our response is to do much more of the same thing.
Alan, you spent years in the public service. You have seen this sausage being made. What are your perspectives from within government and within particularly the public service too, not just at the ministerial or shadow ministerial level?
You did say that you were going to do that, Sally. This is the relationship essentially between policy and politics. And it's a fraught relationship, in my opinion, and has become increasingly fraught at least since 1996. It was probably becoming fraught well before then, but I can date it from the first Howard government because I could see what happened with secretaries of departments who got sacked and the complete change in the relationship between secretaries who are under the law the minister's principal policy advisor, not the staffers, but who are not giving that advice anymore. And Morrison capped that in 2019, just before Christmas, when he gave a very major speech saying, you guys out there, all of you public servants, all you are to do is to implement our decisions. So I think that where we are at the moment is in a very difficult position because ministers are not counselled. They're not advised. Instead, what happens is the public service will do their very, very best to implement the decisions of the government. They will get legal advice from the Attorney General's department, and at some point that legal advice will say, well, look, you're going to have to change the statute and the statutory basis for action. But once you've done that, you can lock people up for longer in jail, but just remember that you've got to legislate it first. So we will look to solutions which allow stupidity to occur rather than look for solutions which are in the broadest common interest. And in the most recent book I've done, I distinguish between hope and optimism. I'm hopeful that we might return to an age when governments get advice, but I'm not that optimistic about it, to answer your question.
Kylie, when you were in Iran, you made friendships and observed what happened to other prisoners from different places. And I wonder what you learned in what helps, what works in trying to, and connected to your work now too, of trying to get incarcerated people out of prison, about what works that we might not know about.
What works in terms of getting people out of prison,
yeah.
Do you mean?
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. I mean, I do think that when you're dealing with a nasty authoritarian regime like Iran or like Russia or China or Venezuela or some of the other culprits of this practice, you have to have carrots and sticks, you know. You can't just adhere to diplomatic niceties and go through the motions of whatever, you know, the consular process is. These people need deterrence. If we want to stop it happening, we need to back up our words with actions and with meaningful efforts to sanction and punish their behaviour. And they only respect in the Middle East. Look at the Middle East right now. You know, they only respect force. They don't respect the Vienna consular conventions or whatever people have signed up to that you're sort of brandishing in their face. They'll laugh, tear it up and do what they want. So Australia, we don't have many levers we can pull, but we have to show that we're serious. If we want to get our citizens out of prison in regimes like China, for example, we have two wrongfully detained Australian citizens in China who are publicly known about. I assume we have far more than that. One has been given a suspended death sentence. What are we doing to actually signal to China, for example, that this is not okay and you better not carry out that death sentence against an Australian citizen who is in prison for writing pro-democracy materials? So, you know, we need to, you know, whilst respecting the international rules-based order, which is in our interest to maintain and uphold, we also need to flex our muscles a bit and be a bit more assertive. And maybe that comes back to what Beck and Alan were saying earlier, in that we're not just sort of subservient and shouldn't just be following whatever the US policy is. Even on this, you know, we need to be a little bit more assertive and sometimes strike out on our own and flex our muscles too.
Are we too risk-averse, like we seem to be in literally every other single area of policy?
Not when it comes to nuclear-powered submarines, we're not. I just wanted to also add to Kylie's point, something like a suspended death sentence is an interesting concept in the Chinese system. We need to even have the understanding in Australia, and the lack of the decline in area studies is a really, I think, a security and diplomatic issue as well, because speaking with my colleague, Professor James Leibold, who you know, Sally, at La Trobe, he's a China expert, and when that news first came out about the suspended death sentence, the first thing he said was, oh, this has a very specific meaning in the Chinese judicial system. And so you need that sort of depth of knowledge to even be able to interpret what a sentence like that might mean for someone. So it goes back to this idea of the importance of understanding, of developing educational strategies that will enable us to be confident and to deploy diplomacy appropriately in the world. But going back to your question, I think sometimes we are quite happy to take risks when it comes to, you know, defence procurement. Obviously, AUKUS seems to me to be a significant risk in terms of at least getting the SSN AUKUS, the kind of last phase of Pillar 1 of AUKUS. There's very few defence experts that I know who actually think that that's going to happen. So then you need to ask the question, well, what is this about? What is AUKUS about? And, you know, we were talking about this last night, Alan. It's probably about basing by stealth. You know, having the US, a greater US presence in Australia. We traditionally don't really feel comfortable with the idea of a permanent US military base in Australia. So this is a way of kind of circumventing some of those debates. But certainly in other areas, we are incredibly risk averse and we just do not spend enough on diplomacy in this country. That's one area where I think we could be braver as a country in thinking about the importance of not just this hard power. It's a very small part of the security picture is the hard power capabilities. We need to be expanding and extending our reach and our resources across all domains of statecraft.
I've noticed in your very lengthy brilliant CV, Beck, that you're president of the Women in International Security Australia's Steering Committee. And I thought, is that an example of something? We could talk about Antarctic security. We could do there's so many. But just that as an example of something that perhaps we might not. What is it, briefly?
The organisation.
Yeah.
So, and actually, Alan, your book at the very start talks about misogyny in national security thinking, and that's where we start from too, that a lot of the voices that are the loudest when it comes to a national security in this country are the same people, and they're male and they're white and they're of a certain generation. And so what Women in International Security Australia, I did point that your book points this out too. And we need male allies too, exactly.
It's a very inclusive festival.
But the whole point of, I mean, this is a global organisation, but the point of the Australian chapter is to make sure that, one thing is that when journalists are looking for people to talk about national security issues, that they have a bigger list of people. They're not just going to ASPE or the National Security College, that there are other people that they can draw upon, because diversity is really, I think, central to these conversations. And so this is what this organisation is doing. And just one last thing is, part of the reason why we wrote this book for La Trobe University Press is because they've done amazing books, really thought-provoking books that are designed for public consumption, How to Defend Australia by Hugh Wide, The Contest for the Indo-Pacific by Rory Medcalf, Four Flashpoints by the excellent Brendan Taylor, but you're probably sensing a theme here. All of these books were published by men. And so Joanne and I are like, well, instead of just complaining about it, we're going to write our own book. And this is what we came up with.
I'm so many of you have texted questions. You must have all look. There's more coming in as I speak. So thank you. I'm going to move to a couple of these. So at least we'll get a few of them in. I'm going to begin with this one because we haven't touched on this yet. And thank you to whoever you are, each of you. Is trade the beginning and end of security relationships? Alan, both of you, of you.
No, trade's not the beginning nor the end. It's not even the middle. And it's because it's a dimension of a relationship, so it's everywhere. Here's a little statistic that just might give you a little help about how I think about America. Sometime this year or next year, the sum total of Australian investment in the United States will be greater than our GDP. Now, the reason for that's obvious. At least I think it's obvious. It's called compulsory superannuation. And the directors of the funds have got responsibilities to put the investment in jurisdictions where it is safest, where the legal system will allow you to protect it, and so on. But don't you think it's incredibly significant that our investment regime will have something equivalent to our GDP, which is $2.6 trillion, invested just in the United States? I'm not including Europe here. Now, that's not trade. That's investment. Trade, though, is an important part of it, but it's got to be seen, I think, as an important element that fits in with everything else. Sally, I might just stop there. I do want to make a further comment about diplomacy, but there'll be a question in there which will allow me to do it, I think.
This might be it, because it's addressed to you. Alan has talked about the role of quiet diplomacy. Do the other panellists agree with this take? How do you decide the time to be noisy and the time to be quiet? Kylie, I'll give you a get Tudor to answer that one.
Well, I would agree with what Alan said in that he said making noise in the arresting country, and normally it's a nasty authoritarian regime, and annoying them, insulting them, pissing them off, whatever, is not going to get you where you want to be. And it's important not to undermine whatever behind-the-scenes negotiations or diplomacy are happening by our government by, you know, hamstringing them verbally and vocally in public. So I completely agree with that. And also I think the second part of Alan's point was that domestically here in Australia, making noise to pressure our own government to do something to help our own citizen has a very different effect. And unfortunately, all governments in Western countries seem to have the same kind of knee-jerk response of keep everything hush-hush, stay quiet, let us handle it, let the experts quote-unquote handle it, you just sit there and wait for us to do our job. And often you're waiting for years and years and don't see much evidence of any progress. So that's why having a very strategic, well-informed and smart public campaign in your home country, kind of targeting your own government, not targeting the arresting regime, can actually do a lot to elevate that person's case and pressure the government into taking those more creative steps that might be needed to secure their release. So broadly, I would probably agree with what Alan said. It really, though, depends on a case-by-case basis and also on which country is holding the person.
Yeah, I agree with that. I would also just like to add, though, that I think there is a bit of a worrying trend. You know, I'm sort of in the national security community, so I'm always very interested in the discourses, and I think there is a trend in some quarters to instrumentalise human rights and issues in a way that may, in fact, actually undermine global human rights. So there's a lot of cherry-picking, for example, about which human rights circumstances matter. And my concern about that is that human rights just gets used as a justification for buying more weapons and feeds into the threat perception and exaggerating a threat perception, and that this isn't actually not always a genuine concern for universal human rights.
I'll come back to these, but I want to get in a little bit more into about how do we know who we can trust and when. Kylie, when you went to Iran, this was done through universities. This was meant to be safe. This was meant to be breaking some ice, breaking through to establish cultural understanding and connection, a form of soft diplomacy through study. How do we know who to trust and when?
The short answer is we can't trust anyone. And I mean, there's nothing, you know, that's one lesson I learned in prison. You know, your cellmates, your fellow prisoners, some of them are scheming against you and informing on you. And, you know, you really have to keep your cards close to your chest. And I think extrapolating out from that on a nation state level, you know, Alan says no friends, no enemies. That's probably correct, but perhaps that's the way it should be. Even our closest friends, quote unquote, even the US, as we've been saying, we shouldn't fully trust them. That would be naive. We always have to keep, you know, our national interest and you know, what's best for Australia front of mind. And knowing that that doesn't always align with our even closest allies. So perhaps we shouldn't fully trust anyone, and we should, you know, be mindful and strategic about our international relationships whilst trying to build bridges and mutual understanding and alliances and this kind of thing too in our international relations. So was that answering your question? I'm not sure.
Absolutely, yeah. Do you have a take on it, Beck?
Yeah, look, I think that's broadly right. I mean, I do believe in the importance of diplomacy in building confidence and in trying to build trust between states and between governments. I'm a constructivist at heart. That means that, you know, we want to have dialogue. We want to have high level conversations between government officials. We want to keep all those channels open. We want channels during times of crisis to be able to diffuse crisis. All of these things are important. But at the same time, we can't be, as Kylie was saying, we can't be naive about that. There's limits on how much trust we can have with other countries. But certainly trust building is still, and more important now that we have sort of this strategic competition, great power rivalry, whatever you want to call it, and you've got these things going on in the South China Sea that are pretty worrying. Building trust is more important in this context rather than it being less important.
Alan, when you're in the room with the, you know, the foreign minister or the shadow foreign minister and talking about various scenarios, does the complete collapse of our system of nation states and security get discussed, or is that just considered silly?
No, it gets discussed all right, particularly if one's working with a gifted minister, and they're not all equally gifted, I can assure you of that.
I really believe you.
But, I mean, it's not hard to lock yourself into a conversation with Penny, because she is very bright. It is never hard to get locked into a conversation with Gareth when he was foreign minister, because he is very bright and he will tell you that straight away.
He loves a conversation.
And similarly with Bob Carr, who very kindly launched my book in Sydney only a couple of weeks ago. He will also tell you that he's very bright, and you can quickly get into that same conversation. Gough Whitlam, I've had that conversation with Gough Whitlam when he was Prime Minister. So the answer is yes, they'll get right into the whole question. Kylie brought it up earlier when referring to pressures within our own society as impacting on our national security. They're really interested in that because it has a political consequence. They're very interested in it as it impacts internationally. But I think that I just want to sort of segue quickly to back to diplomacy, because often people don't really understand what they're talking about when they talk about diplomacy. They think that diplomacy is the advocacy of our interests, and that we get out there and we, you know, like Khrushchev, we take off our shoes and bang the table with it. You're all too young to remember that, but I'm not. Or, you know, it's about asserting your rights. Well, it's not. Diplomacy is what we do in all relationships. We're looking for avenues where people will say, it is in my interests to do what Kylie wants to do. It's in my national interest to accede to what Australia wants to do. And we're not good at that. That's what I think is a big failure in our diplomacy. And if I may just for a moment illustrate that, because it's right in Kylie's field, when Julie Bishop advertised to everybody that she'd given the Indonesian foreign minister a big earful about Chan and Sukumaran, the two Australians who were locked up and were to be executed. In my opinion, that sort of diplomacy virtually guaranteed the outcome.
Oh, I'm going to come in on that because I happen to be quite deeply involved in that story. I visited them for 10 years in their prison in Kerabakan.
And I know you did.
Ah, okay. So I, there is no way I could agree with that remark that Julie Bishop had. She was actually quite marvellous. And I think that those comments came at a point where the decision was done, and she was successive ministers were, and you know, she was the one in the hot seat when the moment came. But I could not agree with that particular remark.
Can I just step in here, because it may not have had an implication for what happened to the two gentlemen, but it did, the ways in which that was discussed in Australia did have an impact more broadly on the Australia-Indonesia
Indeed.
Relationship. Mm. And that's particularly through the use of what we might call civilizational discourses, you know, describing the death penalty in Indonesia as being like, you know, evidence
barbaric.
Of a, yeah, or, barbaric. Yeah, that's exactly yeah. the term I was thinking. We would never say that about the United States, which yes. has the death penalty. So I think there are broader consequences.
Mm-hmm. Oh, gosh, you see, we've got 17 seconds and we've just... very quickly, some closing remarks, I guess, from each of you. About, well, I suppose anything really that's come up today, but about friendship and security, and perhaps what you would like to see the emphasis on very quickly for changes in our security.
Yeah, I would like to see us thinking much more holistically about national security. We need a national security strategy. Defence is always pushing out white papers and updates and defence strategic reviews. We haven't had one in diplomacy since 2017, the foreign policy white paper. It's time for a national security strategy. Alan.
I'd like us to identify the pathologies that hold us back and to address them. Issues around racism, misogyny, the incapacity for self-affirmation, which is terrible in this country, our fundamental insecurity that we need a protector, and that we gallop around doing what our protector wants us to do, a form of sort of foreign subversion, which is very profound. I'd like us to think a lot more about who we are and how we act, and then perhaps to change who we are.
Kylie.
I don't know how to follow up on that profound, these profound musings. Perhaps attempting to do so, we need to think about our rights and responsibilities as citizens and what responsibilities the government has toward us in return. And sort of as a connected to that is this idea of, should the government help you if you're arrested abroad through no fault of your own? Right now, Australians don't even have the right to consular assistance. Most people don't realise that. It is done at the discretion of the government. So you don't even have a right to expect that your government will provide you with those basic, you know, consular, you know, forms of assistance. So I think we have a Senate inquiry coming up into this issue. The group that I've formed has been really active in that, and we're really hoping to push that conversation forward and come up with a set of strategies and ways of not only doing better by those who are held wrongfully abroad, but preventing it from happening in the future as well.
I want to thank the three of you. You've been absolutely fabulous today. I think it's been quite wide-ranging. There's so much that we could have gone on with, my goodness, but it's just been really, really thrilling. You have been a wonderful audience. Please enjoy the rest of the weekend. It is such a great festival here at Bendigo. Thank you again so much to La Trobe University. And once again, please, for our wonderful panel.
You've been listening to a La Trobe University podcast produced by Matt Smith on unceded Wurundjeri country. You can find out more about the Launches at La Trobe program at the La Trobe University website.